Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 381 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 22nd of June, 2018, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Michael Brent Collings about writing, depression and mental health. Now, Michael Brent has been on the show a couple of times before and has been one of the most popular guests because we always have a jolly time with a lot of laughter. Now, we do still laugh at points in our conversation today, but we are talking about some darker topics. And given the recent suicide of Anthony Bourdain and other creatives, obviously today might have some darker moments, but hopefully the conversation will help you personally or will help you understand someone you love. But again, given these are sensitive topics, please consider this a trigger warning. And if you are not in a situation where you can listen to this today, then no worries. We will move into the interview part of the show soon. But first of all, a little personal update. I am 7,000-ish words into Valley of Dry Bones. So really in that sort of finding the way part of the creative process, having some fun with that, enjoying revisiting parts of New Orleans, fictionally, obviously. And I have started my Pinterest board, which is always a part of my fiction process as I do my research. And my fiction is always deeply researched. Then I am putting my pictures onto Pinterest. JF Pen is my Pinterest board. And I'm having real fun with that. So that's good. I am also off to Spain again. It's hilarious because in the first quarter of this year, I didn't do much traveling, but in the second half, I have a lot of traveling going on. So I will be in and out, but always the show will be there for you. I'm not going to record while I'm away, so I'll be doing next week's show as a pre-recorded as well. But yes, off to Spain to the island of Mallorca, which is very exciting, this time for a yoga retreat. So some people have asked me, when are things tax deductible and when are things not? Well, my trip to Madrid and Toledo the other week was book research and was really book research and will go into Valley of Dry Bones. But this week is more about The Healthy Writer. But because I've already written The Healthy Writer, there's no way this can be related. This is yoga retreat and is very much about body stuff, I guess. Now, I've been doing yoga for 2 years now, and after trying and failing at it many times before, I've talked about this in The Healthy Writer and on the show with Dr. Ewan Lawson and things, but yoga really has sorted so much out for me in terms of my back pain and RSI, and also really gets into the crevices of your mind. I was never someone who did any meditation before, and now I do a lot more of it, and I have a lot more functional movement range, which is fantastic. And as I'm only in my mid-40s, I should have a lot of functional movement. But I think as writers, because we emphasize the brain more than the body, we often aren't able to do a lot of things we should be able to. So really, I really love my yoga practice now. It's a big part of my life. I do 3, sometimes 4 classes a week. But this will be my first time doing a retreat twice a day. So yoga twice a day for 5 days. We will see how I am when I get back, and I will give you some thoughts on that. I'm sure I'll be thinking deeper, meaningful things. I will be taking my laptop and I will be doing some writing. So we'll see how that goes. Useful stuff this week. Great news for users of Scrivener and Vellum. And I am someone who writes on Scrivener, so I'm writing Valley of Dry Bones on Scrivener. And when it's all ready, I will export it into Vellum, where I do all my formatting. And Vellum and Literature and Latte, who make Scrivener, have now done a specific integration. So you can just export from Scrivener to Vellum, and they have made sure everything's all nicely done. So that's very cool. So you can find that detailed in the show notes. Also, if you don't use Vellum, or if you need formatting help, I have a page with all the free formatting options and also my tutorial on using Vellum at thecreativepen.com/formatting. There are also professional formatters on that page. So whether you're doing it yourself or if you need help, that has options for doing it for free yourself, all the way to paying for it through my own tutorials. So thecreativepen.com/formatting. So thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Some lovely ones. Brian said, what a fantastic and timely podcast this week with Johanna Rothman. I work in software too, and I use Kanban for my writing projects. I was happily surprised to hear the jargon and learn someone else was leveraging agile methodology tools in their writing. Thanks for having her on the show. It's comforting to know I'm not the only one with crazy project plans and spreadsheets for my books. Thank you, Brian. And what I do love, and I hope that, and I know people don't always listen to the interview. When I listen to podcasts, I don't listen to all the interviews either. So what I really like to do is make sure I have a variety of topics and personalities on the show over time, really trying to sort of show that there are lots of different aspects of being a creative, and whatever your personality, however you do things, you are welcome in the community. Another comment from Melissa said, another great podcast. I love Johanna's idea of working in 25-minute bursts to accomplish a small task. When I'm writing a blog post or fleshing out a novel idea, I try to force myself out of the chair after an hour or so. It sounds like she accomplishes a huge amount of work despite her physical setbacks. Absolutely. Kate Craik said, I was so moved by Johanna Rothman's story. As a fellow writer with chronic vertigo, it's so inspiring to hear someone with similar struggles, though far more severe than mine, achieving so much. And again, this kind of resonates with Michael Brent and the interview that we're doing today. I think when you hear about people who have issues similar to your own, then you can really feel like, okay, there are other people like me and they are managing this. So yeah, even though it's hard, I know I can do that. And then you have other people to follow, maybe other people who you can network with or connect with and see how they manage things. So yeah, I hope today will be just as useful as last week as well. A couple of other things. Troy on Twitter, Troy Photo, says, listening while on a walk in West Los Angeles, found this mural that seemed to fit Johanna's giggles following the release of her new book. Lovely picture of a colourful mural. And yes, I was pretty. I was pretty giggly last week, that's for sure. And A.L. Noor Books says, listening while crossing the Canadian prairies en route to Fernie for mountain biking. That sounds like fun. And finally, thanks to Eliza Peak, who sent me a picture of the Sugar Skull wall at Disney's Epcot World Showcase in Orlando. Fantastic. Very excited about that. So today's show is sponsored by Kovo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from our sponsor in a minute. Thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. I really do appreciate your support. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which is around 40 to 45 minutes of me answering questions from Patreon supporters. And that is a private monthly audio. And of course, you get the whole backlist. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from our sponsor, then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen listeners, I'm Christine Monroe, the senior manager of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free self-publishing platform and a proud longtime sponsor of this podcast. Did you know that you can distribute your ebooks to Overdrive with one click? Right in your Kobo Writing Life dashboard, you'll get the full 50% royalty on the library price you set, which is exactly what you would receive if you had a direct Overdrive account, but without the hassle of managing two accounts. It's the very best royalty rate that you'll see anywhere. And that's because Kobo and Overdrive are sister companies, and we're working together to help library users get the best ebooks from amazing authors like you. We're rolling out Overdrive distribution to all KWL users in the next few months, but if you want access right now, email us at writinglife@kobo.com and we'll get you all set. We encourage authors to set a library price at 1.5 to 3 times higher than their ebook list price, and you'll get 50% of that price every time a library purchases your book. And then your fans can borrow your ebook for free on Overdrive's new app, Libby. That's L-I-B-B-Y. That's right, you get paid 50%, and library users get to read for free. For more information about setting up a free Kobo Writing Life account, head to kobo.com/writinglife. Thanks so much, and I'll hand it back over to you, Joanna.
Today, I'm back with Michael Brent Collings. Hi, Michael Brent.
How are you, Joanna?
I'm good, and it's so exciting to have you back on the show. It is the third time that you've been on the show, I know.
Am I like a record breaker?
Almost, but like Stephen Pressfield is coming on the show for the third time soon. So you're like up there with the Steve.
I want to have like a jacket.
Yeah, a special jacket. I should get some of those. But anyway, just in case anyone has missed our other shows, and I absolutely say people should go back and look at them. But Michael Brent is an award-winning and internationally best-selling horror novelist and screenwriter. His novel, The Deep, one of my favourites, was a finalist in the Bram Stoker Awards. And I really do love his books. I'm not actually lying. I really mean it. Michael Brent also suffers from depression, and that's what we're talking about today, with some laughs in between, I'm sure. But wait, no, seriously, today we're talking about mental health and the writing life, which is a really important topic. Just a disclaimer up front before we get into it, we are not doctors. This is not medical advice, just a discussion on experience, and everyone's experience will be different. So please seek appropriate help for your situation. Okay, that said, Michael Brent, we're going to get into it. So a lot of writers suffer from depression and anxiety, which are kind of words, but they mean different things to different people. So can you start out by talking a bit about your situation, what it means to you, how it impacts your life?
Oh, golly. So first of all, like, I'm going to echo what you said, and especially the talk to somebody, because it never hurts to talk to somebody. I mean, unless you get a very rare person who's like, I'm going to shovel pills down their throat now, you know, which is part of the pharmacological answer. It's better to talk to somebody than take a chance on being all alone, which is one of the worst parts of being anxious or having depression. So as far as how it impacts me, there's goods and bads to it. In certain respects, the bads are, I'm already in a lonely profession. We've already chosen this job where we live in a cave. And even like, I go out every day and I work at a different place with people, because I know if I live in a cave, my wife will come in one day and there'll just be like a greasy smudge where I used to be, because I will have imploded of sadness, you know? But even if I'm out with people, I have my headphones on and I'm in my little world, and all the voices that you hear as a writer are your own echoed back at you through these really odd echo chambers that make them sound sort of like somebody else, which actually gives them a sort of more credence. So it's very, or credibility, it's very easy to fall into this as a writer, because one of the critical components of depression is always this sense of being cut off, being alone, being hopeless. And we do that to ourselves on purpose. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the job, like I say, but it is a very challenging thing. And, you know, me personally, the way it impacts me is first of all, you know, there's days where my wife will come in, and I'm usually up and gone before anybody else is, because I have sleeping issues too. So it's not unusual for me to just leave at 2 a.m. and be back at 6 the next night. And my wife will text me and be like, are you safe? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. And then there's days where she comes in and it's 11 o'clock and I'm just this kind of worm in the middle of the bed. And she knows something is dreadfully wrong. And the thing that day is it's not going to be, you know, a 60 page of writing day. It's going to be, let's see if I can put pants on. Mm-hmm. And your goal system kind of moves. And that's actually one of the hardest things, is kind of to deal with the realities of a changing situation, because you feel like, oh, I wrote, you know, be it 1,000 or 20,000 words yesterday, I should be able to do that every day. And today, I'm going to go to the bathroom like a human. That's the good thing to do today, you know? So it's really hard just knowing that your brain, it's like it's pulled a really dick move, because it was my best friend for 30 years almost. And then it's like, I was pretending. Now I'm going to betray you slowly over time, you know? So that's really the hardest part, is just trying to cope. Because also a lot of writers, like, especially if you kind of get to a point where you're doing well, or not necessarily making money, but you're doing stuff you like, most writers have established a real routine. And then to have your brain go, but we're not doing it today. Why? Because it's Wednesday, you a-hole. And having no rhyme or reason, that's tremendously, it's crippling. And it just feels like it eviscerates your competence level. And so that's really hard. On the other hand, I get to have cool talks with people, and I get to go on panels, and people go, you know, I have this mental health issue. I have this mental health issue. And I can go, I have major depressive disorder with suicidal tendencies and psychotic breaks. And there's this like hush, like, we're going to listen to him. you can really affect people. And that's really great, because those little moments of connection are the thing that's going to save you.
And, you know, really thank you for sharing on the show, because a lot of people, this is the thing, I personally have not had depression. I've been depressed, which is not the same as depression, as you know. But I have people who I love who do have episodes of it. So I did, before we circle back to you, I actually do want to ask about your wife, because a lot of people listening, if they don't suffer from depression, will know people who do, or will be in writers groups where there are people who might be going through this. So, you know, you said your wife texted you, you know, if you're not there, she'll be like, are you safe? So what else can people do to help those who have depression? Like, from what I understand, it's just, you're so in yourself, it's very hard for someone to help you. But what can we practically do without sounding like, you know, kind of idiots, like, oh, buck up, you know, or take some pills?
Okay. Next time you feel like saying that, find someone who's got cancer and tell them, you know, if you smiled more, that lymphoma would not be as bad for you. Yeah. Or, you know, I know there's a bone jutting out of your shin, but if you would man or woman up, the marathon would be doable. That's just the worst thing to say to somebody, is just be happy, just exercise, you know. And I'm a person who goes to church. I'm a person with a very deep faith. And that's one of the few areas where, like, I don't think faith and science are at all necessarily opposed. There's ways to work with them both. But people of faith will say, like, if you prayed more, you know, you might feel better. And that's not good either. My response is always like, Jesus, as I recall, had a pretty bad night in Gethsemane. And if he had bad nights, I should be permitted the weakness of having a couple bad nights.
That's, you know, a really good example.
So you can't say, oh, you would be better if you did this differently. I mean, you might be helped and maybe you would be better. But to say it in that instant, the reality that you have to remember as a caregiver or as a friend is, it's not that they're finding a good decision and then saying, I'm going to make the different decision. It is that in the little room of their minds, that decision does not exist. And I mean, to the point where even my wife will say, okay, get out of bed. And if I'm really bad, I will stare at her. And I hear the words. Depression doesn't make you stupid. But what it happens is, I hear the words and they literally don't make sense to me. It would make as much sense to me if she said, okay, let's just stand in front of the street at night, dressed like the Black Ghost. That'll help you. You know, you're going to look at her and go, I don't think it will, you know. And you're not being unreasonable. It's just the way your brain works. So the biggest thing any caregiver can do, I think, is to give you a sense that they're there right now. And when this is through, they're still going to be there. Every time I get my worst, one of the things that I go to is I'll look at my wife, who I adore. I mean, she is the one thing that's like a worldly thing that I absolutely worship. And I will look at her, this person that I've hung my soul on in so many ways, and say, you should divorce me. And it's not because I'm being like, that's not even a, I'm woe is me and pat me on the back. It is, I've gone through this in my head and I'm hurting you to the point where you should leave because I love you. And when I'm feeling good, that's nonsense, you know, because I make her smile and I make her happy. But in my head, she needs to leave. And so getting a sense even once that she's like, maybe there's something to that, that's going to be the most devastating effect. So I know that's the one thing I know. She's here now. And sometimes she goes, I can't be with you in this room because I have things to do. I have to move forward. But I'm here whenever you call, whenever you need me. Even if like I'm doing something that is critical that I must do, I will talk to you. I'll be there for you. And if any caregiver has that patience to do it for someone who's really, really having problems, best thing you can do.
And, you know, I talk about death on this show, so we can go there. And the thing is, although I don't really, I've never felt major depression as you have, I have had suicidal thoughts. I think that that doesn't need to be equated with depression. It can be something separate. Sure. But I certainly have been through that. I wrote about it in my book, Delirium. And it's something that, you know, as we talk in, you know, a week or so ago, Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, Robin Williams, you know, interestingly, because you're very funny as well. Being funny and having humor doesn't mean that you don't suffer from these deep depressions. So
I'm the happiest sad person you'll ever meet.
Yeah, exactly. As everyone assumed Robin Williams was. And, right. and this is the thing. So, just on the suicide thing, which is a big issue and a big topic, I know, but what stops people from doing that in the end of the day? Like, is it your wife? Is it God? Can you see a way through to a future where you're not in that darkness? I guess that's the thing.
Yeah. I think there's two things that have helped. And one is, yes, that connection. And again, like, part of the reason I'm like this, I'm naturally a very, very introverted person. So when I was young, I was small, I was smart, and I was socially awkward, which meant I saw the insides of lockers and trash cans and I got beat up. And also, P.S., no woman would look at me. And so I went to my mom, who's this just wonderfully bubbly, smiling, kind person. I said, how do I make friends? And she wrote down a list of 10 things and I memorized it. So all of this is just I memorized it well enough. Like I do karate, I can do a roundhouse kick without thinking about it. And I know to smile. I know to look at you in the eyes, which is not what I like doing. I know to say your name and thank you and all those things. So it's important that, first of all, when you're not being depressed, you not be depressed. That you get out there and be with people. And that leads to the second thing, and participate with them. Don't just stand there, like, be with them. Because the second thing is, in those moments of deep darkness, yeah, the things that keep it from happening, that will always keep it from happening, are nothing more than, this would be terribly inconvenient for my loved ones, at least for a few weeks. And I don't like to inconvenience people. Man, I've never left the toilet seat up my whole marriage. My wife's like, you know, this is astounding, right? But I just don't want to inconvenience her. So I'm like, if I won't leave up the toilet seat, but then I'm like, you got to find a funeral home and a plot, you know. So really, it sounds silly, but just think about, like, even in the short run, this is going to suck. And do I want to do that to my friends? And faith goes along with that, too. And I'm not saying, like, everyone has to get religion. Obviously, I don't talk about mine specifically because that's more of a one-on-one thing, you know. I'd rather make people awkward face-to-face than do it en masse in a podcast. But there is that. It's like, I believe that's not a right choice and that there's a capital good, G good, capital E evil, and suicide's not on the good side. So I just want to stay away from it. And that helps. That really does. And so having those connections. And then the last thing is, so going along with what we said earlier, it's not feasible to look at a person and say, if you just feel better, that presents an immediate fix that is impossible. But what you can say as someone suffering depression, I have found, and what a caregiver can say is, you're feeling horrible. There's nothing you can do about it. And you cannot look forward to hope. You cannot sit there and think, I'm going to be hopeful. But what is possible, and it's a little mental hoop to jump through that really works for me, is I go, I can't be hopeful, but I can hope that I'll be hopeful. And I can just repeat to myself, if I get through 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, whatever it is, I can put a clock and say, I believe at the end of this, I'll smile again. And it doesn't feel real, but I can keep repeating it, keep repeating it, keep repeating it. And that's been a tremendous help.
Yeah, that's really good. And I do, I laughed about that. I don't want to inconvenience people with the body. Because, and I think I want to normalize this because I've heard this from so many people now. And I, because I talk about death and suicide and things with lots of my friends, because I'm that kind of person.
Who doesn't?
I mean, who doesn't? Yeah. But it's interesting because that same thing I have heard over and over again. And people are like, oh, I'm just so embarrassed about feeling like that. And I'm like, but seriously, I've heard that before. It's kind of incredible that people, you know, are stopping themselves from doing this thing in order not to inconvenience others. But yet those loved ones clearly want them not to do that. So I just wanted to normalize that. Because when you said that, I was like, yep, I've heard that before. And just for people listening, that is, I think it must be a normal human thing, you know, to think that.
It goes along with not being a sociopath. You know, you want to be kind to people. And honestly, here's the other thing is, don't overthink it. If you find something that's working, screw why it works. Mm. Just let it work. You know, I do not, when I microwave a burrito, I don't sit there and go, why does this burrito work in this way? I just eat the frickin' burrito and suffer the consequences, you know, and that's like it is with all medicine. We do not require, most of us, an explanation of how the lipids are bonded and kept away from this or that thing. We just go, will the pill work? Taking the pill. And maybe we do that too much. But the point is, if you find something that's like, okay, it might not be, don't set your bar necessarily for I'm going to be well. Just I'll get through every day as it comes. And whatever you found that works for that, do that. Because I am telling you, unless you are a very old man, very old with a little tiny white mustache named Hitler living in Paraguay, somebody out there values you. And you do have a story to tell. You have an astounding universe that you inhabit. And I believe this truthfully. I have never met somebody so smart, so dumb, so rich, so poor, that there isn't something about them that I could sit there and listen to for hours. And if you take yourself out of the picture and I occupy that space, I will feel the lack. And someone's going to meet you. Someone's going to miss you. They might not even know it. They'll just, you know, they'll feel this moment where nothing's happening and something could have happened. Mm-hmm. And that something could be you. So don't ever think I'm not making a positive difference, because to me, you absolutely do. You have met a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend who gave me a smile and got me through that day. So don't you dare.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's interesting. So you talk about the universes that people have and, I mean, obviously, you write horror, and a lot of the stuff you write is dark, yeah, you know, and awesome. So, and also, you put on your Patreon, deadening pain means deadening life. So, how much of your own darkness and suffering, you know, do you put into your writing, and does it help? Like, is it something that writer, you know, just use it, man?
Yeah. Yeah, well, okay, so I just finished reading for my wife, because I read her all my books, but I write a lot and we have busy lives. So sometimes it's like I wrote a book almost a year ago called The Dark Lights. And I finally finished reading her that book. We usually, our reading time is the Costco trip. Like we'll put something on for the kids in the back and I'll read her scary books and hope they're not listening. And I flipped the last page on my Kindle and she looks at me and goes, I did not like that ending. And that was written during the worst period of my life. Mm. Now, as bad as I feel and as dark as some of my stories are, they do exist, all of them, in a moral framework. And I would never put out a book that's just like, I'm going to vomit my black all over you, my bile, for no other reason than because it will be good for me, because that's therapy. And the one thing all therapists and psychiatrists have in common in the world is you pay them. And so for me to do that on the page and then say that'll be $5, that's ridiculous, I think. And it's also, people say, like, I follow my art wherever it goes, and I'm going to be rude and say a word. Like, I'm not a big cusser, but when I hear, I'm going to follow my art wherever it goes, and it doesn't matter what the consequences are, I want to go, you're not an artist, you're just an asshole. Because we have a responsibility to build communities. That's the big power of being a writer. Mm-hmm. And if you're just vomiting out evil because it makes you feel better, you're just a sociopath. And so even when I'm feeling bad and dark and evil, what I do is I sit there and go, everybody feels this way. Like you said, you've not had, you know, depression, clinical depression, but, and I use it as quotes as a real thing, not as like depression, but you've been depressed. And so when you read my book, it normalizes you and you go, oh, well, this guy, this author, this character feels this way. And so even though I might not go out, snap and murder people, there is this part of me that goes, oh, this is part of the human experience. And if I'm human, I belong. And that, again, is one of those keys to sticking around. So I'm fine putting those dark parts in my stories. And even if the dark part is in a bad, bad person who does snap, that makes you into a hero because you go, I have these feelings and I've controlled them for the sake of my humanity. And that's a wonderful thing. So I don't think you need to avoid who you are. My view of being like, again, as a person of faith, I don't think we go to sit on clouds and play harps, same exact music, same exact robe, same exact everything. I think you go to heaven and you continue working. And the difference is you're your best self. And so the job of an artist is to bring out the best self of other people. And you do that by showing them everything and saying everything fits in this best thing. You just have to find the way to properly deal with it or channel with it. So if you sanitize your universe, you know, you're the boy in the bubble, you will die at the first cold. I'm dealing with this with my son who is so, he wants to do good. And it's not like we taught him that. He came out at the age of zero, like crawling very carefully. We never had to worry about him sticking something in the light socket because he knew, he's like, that's not the right choice. And and now we're going, you kind of have to get out there. You don't have to do bad things, but you need to know how they work or else one of them is going to kill you. And I really believe that. And that's one of the wonderful things about horror is it shows you that there's darkness that can be overcome. That's the thing that horror does when it's doing well.
Mm, and actually, I was going to say that I consider your writing to be like what I think of as proper horror, which is exactly that, which is the good versus, it really is good versus evil, life versus death. And there will, lots of people will die, but good will triumph. And yeah. That's why I like your books. And that's why some of Stephen King's gets it, you know, but the horror I don't like is when it is just all darkness with no glimmer of light. And I think that's really important. And I love what you said about the therapy there. And yeah, we definitely do not use your writing as therapy. I think it can be cathartic. Like, yes. I like, you know, kicking some ass in my books from the bad guys and things. And they're always going to get their comeuppance in the end because that's how my universe works. but it's, as you say, you can't use it as therapy.
By the way, I will say on the air, again, I loved Map of Shadows. I got to read it early. Oh, it was so good. So I'm on that whole, like, that series
Oh, thank you. That means
check
so much
that out,
to me.
Guys.
Yeah, it so means good. A lot to me. I really appreciate that. But before I blush too much and we're like mutual fanning, I wanted to just sort of move on to In the Healthy Writer, which my friend Dan Holloway wrote a chapter. And he is bipolar. And he talked about writing advice being useless for most people with mental illness. Oh, look, it's on your phone for the audio.
I have so many quotes. I was ready to bust out. It was so good.
I'm glad you liked it because the chapters on mental health were really interesting. And so you've already mentioned that some days you can't write. Like the advice to write every day doesn't work for someone with depression. But you've also, on your Patreon, you've talked about you had a 27,000 word day, which to me felt like mania. That really felt like a manic episode from someone who, you know, but I don't know whether it was for you. So what are some of your tips for writing as someone who has these cycles? Basically, they are cycles, aren't they?
Yeah. Just they're like, so my oldest daughter has become a woman. You know what I'm talking about. And I have no problem with that. That's part of the human life, you know, but my son's like, why is she like this sometimes? And I told him, I said, you know what? Women are like that sometimes, but they at least have the courtesy to schedule it. And men just do it periodically for no frickin' reason. So don't get all over her. She's just more polite about her mood swings. And so we all have these ups and downs. And the problem with depression and depressive episodes is they're not necessarily regular. They're never regular. And again, that's hard to deal with because you're like, I'm looking forward to Monday. I've got all these great ideas. It's going to be a great week. And Monday hits you in the face like a sack of nail-covered bricks. And it's terrible. And so you kind of have to roll with it. One thing that is helpful to remember is writing. And we talked about this on the Writer's Block podcast episode. But writing is not typing. And writing is not doing this with a pen. Writing is this whole process, and some of that process is thinking, and some of that process is seeing other people's work. And so on bad days, my wife gets me out of bed, and she knows I'll feel bad if I haven't worked because I haven't done my part. And that's a very normal thing, too, for people with this issue. And she'll say, go to the movies, and she'll drive me to the dumbest movie she can locate. She's like, this looks like it blows stuff up good. And I can sit there in the audience, often by myself. It's like, you know, it's an 11 a.m. matinee for the crappiest movie that's out. And I'm just watching something stupid. But part of my brain can't help but go, well, that's stupid. Well, that's stupid. And so I'm analyzing things. And that's part of your job as a writer. And I get to the end and I go, did I have a 27,000 word day? No. Did I do a little thinking about my stories? Yeah, you can't help it as a writer. That's part of the problem is you can't turn it off. And so let it work for you. Have a friend who's like going to come in and physically drag you bodily to the movies or sit you in front of, you know, Daredevil on Netflix that you've seen 42 times already. But you're like, I remember this part. That was awesome. I should put more kicks in my book, you know. It's a totally legitimate writing process, and that's a wonderful thing. So you don't have to equate, like, I didn't write today with I didn't do my job, because you probably did. You're just not giving yourself the leeway to realize it. So part of it's that. Part of it, yeah, if I'm feeling good, it was not a manic episode. I just needed to get crap done because I'd had a lot of tough weeks physically and mentally because I suffer from severe chronic pain as well. And so I got to a point where I had set a deadline. I had missed it. Life's like that. But I said, I don't want to get it too far out. So I drove my car into the mountains. I got out with my computer and I typed on the side of a dusty road until I couldn't type anymore. And then I dictated until my voice went, and I was there from 7 a.m. until 3 the next morning. Did I pee off the side of the road? Yes, I did. But that was fine. And it was a good day. And it wasn't a manic episode. It was just like, okay, I'm functioning. Let's take advantage of it. And that's a good feeling too, because, you know, you don't get to do 3,000 words a day, 3,000 words a day, which is what, you know, I did 5,000 words a day for 5 years. I put out 8 books a year. And now I can't do that, but I can still have days where I go, I'm just going to face brag a little bit here, guys. I did 27,000 words because my life's perfect. Despair all ye sad people. But, you know, that's kind of cool. Mm. You get to group your triumphs, and nobody is happy at the Olympics about the pole vaulter who always came in third his whole career. They're like, hooray, the underdog won the gold medal. So you get to be the underdog gold medaling it periodically. And that's freaking awesome.
Mm. I think that's so important. And I mean, I am someone who can do the routine and the schedule, and I know that I can get up and do stuff, and that unless I've had a few drinks, I'll probably be fine every morning. And
nobody notices.
No, exactly. But I think this, again, it's so important to normalize some of these experiences, which again is what, you know, Dan did in The Healthy Writer and you're talking about, is that it's not a big deal. If you go a day, a month, a year, whatever it is, the period that is down. And then, as you say, when you're on that upswing, you can take advantage of it. And I mean, I absolutely, when you put that on your Patreon, and of course you were talking about pain and dark stuff, and I'm like, 27,000 words? I wish I could do that. But of course, that's completely ridiculous because I've done 27,000 words over, say, 10, 15 days on a on a schedule that you can't necessarily do. So for people listening, like, there's no right way, is there, to write a book? I mean, look at all your books. You still finish books.
The only wrong way to write a book is not writing it. Mm. And so you can't say, I'm going to only do it this way or I'm not going to do it, because then you have abrogated your last little bit of authority. You've given it up. And, you know, life is the thing that's hard about so much of life is how much we realize as we grow older that we don't have control over it. That's such a tough thing. Hold on, I'm the captain of my ship. I don't know. He must have been so, so wasted when he wrote that, because it's not accurate. And that's really hard. But you can say, I don't have control of these factors, but when the decision is mine, I will whatever it is. And that is a control that actually is a through line that runs through your life. Given the choice, I will whatever. And you've made the decision to make that decision. And again, anytime you toss it back, when you do kind of assert yourself a little easier, I can't be hopeful, but I can hope I'll be hopeful. I can't decide to feel better, but I can decide when I do feel better, this is what I'll do. And that's really important, no matter who you are. I mean, to be able to look at a crap day where everything went wrong, which is called, like, you know, Thursday, to be able to go, all right, well, tomorrow it'll be Friday. And I will make the choice because it'll be in my control again. So yeah, don't fall into this pit of saying, because Joanna does it. And I've told you, I love your writing. When I read Map of Shadows, I was like, because you gave it to me early and said, what's your feedback? And I said, I didn't like this person's name. That was as much feedback, negative, as I had. But I can't look at Joanna and say, she wrote this really great book and she's not depressed. And it's because your system works. And so we just have to find systems that work for us. And that's experimentation. And that does suck, especially because when you have mental health issues, your brain is a moving target. It's not like, you know, I go to a psychiatrist and it's not like he goes, sink, we found the right pill. And that's it. And he goes, I'll never see you again, you know, because in 6 months, this one time he said, well, the problem is it's summer. And so you've got too much serotonin because sunlight does that. So we have to adjust your meds. I'm like, wait, I have to do this every freaking 6 months. And that's stressful. So you have to kind of recognize, again, look, I can't control the doohickey crap in my brain. And I certainly can't control if my loved one is acting terrible. I can influence it, but I can't control it. I can't control if my job goes under because the company goes bust. You know, I'm working in Microsoft. A couple of years ago, and you probably felt this too to some extent, a lot of self-pubs went out of business because Kindle changed its business model, and it was devastating for a lot of people when they moved to this Kindle Unlimited stuff. And there's people that are working with it great now, but I couldn't sit there and say, well, that was my fault. You just kind of have to go, okay, well, how can we adjust to the best of our ability? And the best of our ability, that's a great benchmark. And Dad's got mental health problems. And his psychiatrist said, you have to allow yourself the leeway of being mediocre. And my dad was like, oh, I don't have to be everything the best in the world. I can be passable. And passable means you're doing it good enough.
Mm.
So, you know, we can do that sometimes.
Yeah, fantastic. Right. We are, like, you and I could talk forever. I'm sure you'll be back on the show again. But I do want to ask you some things that are not related to depression. Because I think what, you know, you mentioned the movies there and you're a screenwriter. And on the horror thing, I just wanted to ask, like, what are your thoughts right now? Because I think Netflix is doing a heck of a lot more supernatural and darker films, darker TV. Do you think that there's a kind of renaissance in the supernatural slash horror slash darker stuff coming through? And is it, you know, with script writing, because, you know, I'm interested in that. Are things becoming better, easier, changing in that area?
Easier, yes, for writers in certain ways, harder in others. But no, it's absolutely not a renaissance. Here's what it is. Horror has always been incredibly popular and incredibly profitable because the Avengers made $2 billion on a $500 million movie with $300 million in marketing. So it's got a multiplier of like 1.4.
Hmm.
Halloween had a multiplier of 1,000,000%. That is a better return. So horror has always been there. It's always been easier to break into horror. If you write The Avengers as your first script, and you and I talked about this, you know, as good as all your pieces are, I said, you're going to have an easier time selling it to somebody who's got a track record than doing, you know, your Map of Shadows, because it's kind of a huge story.
It's too big, you know, too expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you write a horror film, you can go to someone and say, hey, this is going to cost $5, which or $5 million, which is like, in Hollywood, the equivalent of buying a Volkswagen from 1982, it's just not a big deal. And all they have to do is put it in theaters and it's going to make money.
Mm.
Every one of my films, I think, well, both of them, which is actually a lot to have actually made, they've made money. They were small budgets. It wasn't the Avengers. And I still get little royalty checks, which is fantastic.
Mm.
Horror is easier to break into than other genres. It's still really hard as far as screenwriting. So I'm in the Writers Guild of America, in it, which you have to have sold some scripts or had some credits, and then you pay them $3,000 and then a percentage for the rest of your life. And it is harder to get into that group statistically than to get into Major League Baseball. So mm-hmm. This is a tough world, but horror is the easiest part to break in. But it's not a renaissance because it's always been there. What we have now is groups like Netflix who put out a stream of horror at the beginning. And it wasn't they were making it or anything. It was just they had Supernatural. They had all the old horror movies. And they have a huge data accumulation. And they look at it not from the perspective of Universal putting out three horror movies that did really well and critics hated them. So something must be wrong with horror. Netflix goes, well, according to actual data, people love this stuff and it's the most cost effective. We can put out, you know, they put out Bright, the movie.
I love by that. David Ayer. Gotta say, I loved it.
You know what? I didn't get why everyone beat it up.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was $100 million movie. And I'm guaranteeing at the end of the day, they're sitting there going, we'll make Bright 2 because it is in the pipeline. Because it made a return and it made a splash, more importantly. I bet it lost money a little bit, actually, but there was so much talk, it brought more people in. And then they look at Hemlock Grove and they look at all of the, you know, all of the Human Centipede movies that cost $1.50 to make, and they picked them up for a 400% return for the guy who made it, and they made $5 on it. So it's a very obvious decision once you're looking at it from an accumulation of lots of data. And also because any artistic venture, doesn't matter if you're a writer or a producer or anything, it is impossible to listen to this, people listening. It is impossible to make a living selling your books. The only way you can do it is by having other people sell your books. Because you're only going to reach a certain number of people. And what you need to have is a little cult of folks that go out and talk to everybody about your stuff. And horror is full of those culty people. And so Netflix knows if they put on Supernatural, which isn't horror, but it's got horrific stuff in it, that crowd is going to go to every convention and talk to every person about either how scary it is or how dreamy the two main guys are. And they don't care which, frankly, because more people are going to watch Supernatural. I have freaking tried to watch Supernatural 8 times. I hate it.
I don't like it either.
But I keep trying because so many of my friends insist they're just sitting there drinking Supernatural Kool-Aid being like, it's great. And I go, it must be great. So they've got me, you know. And so Netflix knows this. They've got all this information and all these algorithms, and they are a data-based company. They're not an entertainment company. Mm. They're putting out data. They're taking in data and they're making business decisions off of it. And so we're finally seeing them, some big company going, there's something to this horror, but it's not a renaissance. There's always been great horror. There's always been wonderful stuff out there, and there always will be, because we have that in us and we need to be reminded that it's okay and that we can beat it.
Yeah, I agree on Supernatural. I didn't gel with it, I think, because it's not dark enough. I tell you what, I rewatched Constantine with Keanu Reeves the other day.
So good.
Oh, that is a great movie. And I was just like, yep, that's the good stuff right there. Yeah. Yeah, so
that's a remote drop for me. Every time it's on TV, it's like, you know, TNT 2 in the morning, I go, oh, Sharknado 14's on. I do like that. Constantine. Yeah, because I... There's
got demons in. We love demons. Oh. Right. And my last question, I wanted to ask you about your new covers, because including The Deep, the fantastic book, you did a great new cover on that. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Show it to the camera for the video people, because that's out of shot otherwise. See if we can. Oh, yeah. It's like a ship with a skull in a sea of blood. It's awesome. Yeah. I love it. I think it's brilliant.
Upside down and right side up.
It's so good. And so it's very interesting because, of course, you've been writing for a long time. And some of these books are older. And I think I said to you, I think you need another cover. And clearly other people do. So it did as well. So tell us a bit about revisiting older books with new eyes and trying to kind of rebrand them with a more modern cover.
Well, okay. The first thing I say, first of all, yeah, it wasn't many people. It was you and this one other woman I respected who were very nice. You were both nice about it, but it was very clear. The nice thing you were saying was these suck now, you know, because 10 years ago, or I guess 7 or 8 when I started, there wasn't competition. You could, you know, my first cover was made in Word and I just went and I printed it as a PDF on the computer and that was good enough, you know? Mm. And now it's a lot more sophisticated and self-pub is much less the redheaded stepchild. I mean, I can see your books in the background and Stone of Fire is there and Desecration, and those have super cool covers and they're very slick now. You know, they have to be slick and keep up with the traditional publishing. And I've said this before, if you're an indie, you can't be good. You have to be better than traditional publishing, because why would someone read my book if Stephen King's there? And the reason is I have to be giving him a $15 book just like him for $5. And so you do have to keep ahead of this stuff. I would recommend, first of all, for most people, have someone else make your cover. Because the reason I do it is because I need lots of outlets, because I do have a fractured personality. And so, like, I do so many random things that I just do them. I love karate. I do contact juggling. I'm sitting there in the car doing like the labyrinth thing from David Bowie and people are going, whoa, he's messed up, you know? And I loved, you know, so when you guys said these covers are terrible, I'd been using GIMP, which is a decent photo manipulation tool. And I went, I'm going to learn Photoshop. So for 2 months, I sat in my room watching YouTube videos of Photoshop. And I really had to listen to people who, why does my cover suck? Well, it's got this problem. I'll fix that problem. Why does it still suck? You were great because you're like, it's not quite there. It's not quite there. And that was really helpful. You need to have honest people around who will be like, he's not depressed today. He won't blow his brains out if I tell him he needs improvement. and that's important, you know. So I would recommend most people don't do that. They don't have the personality. And it's a better outlay to pay $200. I'll do a cover for you for $300. I've started doing them for other people because I like it. I'm serious, man. Email me. I'll be like, $300. I'll do you a cover. It'll be decent, you know?
Let's just say this is June 2018. Do not come back in like 5 years' time when you're like...
Yes, if you see like Michael Brent Collins' movie outdid the Avengers, I'm too busy.
Sorry.
You know? But the point is, like, I will do that because I like it. And I've got some competency and I have a background that affords me a little bit of expertise as a base. Because I do work in movies and I've always done that stuff. And book covers are just kind of more single image movie covers, really. They have a single image as kind of their key, and movie covers can be a little bit more complex. But most people just pay someone. You'll save yourself 2 months of practice at the least. You could have put out a whole book maybe, or at least gotten a good start on another book. So just have someone do covers. Look at covers that are selling. Look at covers by your friends who say, I'm a cover artist. And if it's like their first gig out of school, I don't want to be rude, but like, I'll let you do my cover if it's free, because you can build your portfolio. And I'm not guaranteeing it'll stay on for more than 6 days. And that's okay too. You can update your covers as many times as you want. Mm-hmm. I think my cover, do I have it? Oh yeah. So this book is called Peter and Wendy. And oh, look, there's Joanna in the
in the reflection. That'll be a gloss so cover.
This book's called Peter and Wendy, and it's been through like 4 covers. And that's cool. You know, I get to do that. So all you have to do is do a new cover and click upload. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're doing it for $200 or $300 a pop, that gets expensive. So again, find somebody competent first. But if it's a mistake, you can re-update. Your covers have gone through various iterations.
Oh, yeah. And I think part of it is, like you mentioned, Desecration. Like, that is the third cover on Desecration. And it's kind of part of understanding what the book is as well, I think. It's because, and like I said about the deep, you know, because I know that book so well, because I've actually read it like twice, which is more than like double what I read most novels. and that new cover is just so much, so right. And yet it's odd how you had even put that other cover on. And I think about Desecration as well. It's like, how did I even put that cover on that book? Do you think we're developing an understanding of our own products or our own art over time?
Yeah. And also you just understand the market better. Because so like when I did The Deep, I knew the first cover I did, I was never happy with it. But I had a self-imposed deadline and I did it. And it was, you know, it was a not good cover, but it sold enough books. I was okay with it. And that was the Bram Stoker Award finalist. So obviously it wasn't a bad enough cover to turn people off who already knew me, which is good. But at the same time, I hated it. I knew it wasn't good. And so part of it is you're in the industry for 10 years and you get a sense for, well, that is a obviously first out of the gate indie cover, and I don't want that. Mm. And here's something for you people who are considering cover work. It is not necessarily about your story at all. Mm. There is no scene in The Deep with a yacht, which is on the cover of my book. Mm. There certainly isn't a scene where the underside of the yacht is a skull. The only thing that a cover is supposed to do is give a sense of the feel for the book, what, you know, what kind of genre you're getting into, have a question on it that must be resolved and can only be resolved by reading the book. What is this about? Is it about a bloody scene? I mean, like, I'll check the first page and I should get you on the first page or I'm not doing my job. And the last thing, and the most important now, it has to be a fish hook on your eyeball at a half an inch thumbnail, which is why they've gotten less artsy. Don't ever think like that's a wonderfully artistic cover, because it doesn't matter. People go to museums for art. They go to Amazon for books, and it's got to have this thing that like pops out at you really small. Even if it's just a flash of all of your books in the background, you can see there's dark around the outlines, and then there is a colorful spot in the center. That's actually a design technique. A lot of designers put a circular bright spot. It looks like an eye. It catches our eye because we're biologically wired for that. And then your other books up top, The Healthy Writer and the How to Market a Book and all those, they have this big contrast of white to dark. And it's a thing that you you kind of have to look at. And that's the first thing you have to sit there and go, look at all of these covers. There's a place you can go called 99 Designs, and it's not always great, but you can have a bunch of people try and make a cover for you. And if you scan through the list of 100 covers and the one you like doesn't pop out, that's not the one you should get. Buy it on your own and hang it in your wall, but it's going to suck as a cover.
Yeah, so good. Oh, as ever, we could talk forever, but we need to close up for now. So just tell people where they can find you and all your books online.
Okay, so you can find me on my website, which is writteninsomnia.com, books that'll keep you up all night. I have a Patreon page called patreon.com/mywaronsuicide. And because I'm depressive, you're not going to get something every week or every day, but I try and do two or three a month. Last month I missed. The month before, I think I put up five. So you're going to get a steady trickle of stuff. And hopefully it's helpful for caregivers to understand and for people who suffer it to go like, hey, he wrote another post. That guy didn't kill himself. That's fantastic. And I will have my wife cancel it if I ever die. So you'll know I'm still there. And the easiest way to find me is just Google the name Michael Brent, because that's my first name. And there's no other weirdo in the world whose parents hated him enough to name him Michael Brent.
And just a heads up, at some point we are all going to die. So fair
and
enough.
If you die, you can let your credit card run on the Patreon page for a couple months before
that's
they catch
good,
it.
A good point. But look, as ever, Michael Brent, it's been so good to talk to you. I always enjoy our talks. And although we had quite a serious one today, I hope people found it really useful. And I'm looking forward to you coming back on the show at some point. We will no doubt.
With my jacket.
Yeah, with your jacket. We will do this again. So thanks again and see ya.
See ya.
So I hope you found the interview with Michael Brent helpful today. I know this is a difficult subject, but it is such an important one, since something like one in four people suffer depression in their lifetime. And the more we talk about it, the more people will feel it's okay to say they are suffering. And we all want to support each other in the writers community. But next week, we'll be switching gears and I will be talking about how to redesign your life to prioritize your writing with David Cadavy. We have a fantastic chat about all kinds of productivity stuff, as well as moving countries to live more cheaply. David moved from the USA to Colombia, which is very exciting. And how we also talk about how to make money writing on Steemit, which is on the blockchain. And I am just starting to play with that. And I am really excited about it. So that is coming up next week. Have a wonderful writing week. And I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.